There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Science, exercise, nutrition, health, energy, passion. 1 year, no beer. This is the 1 year No Beer podcast, where you will find all the latest tips, tricks, and hacks for a way to live better.
Today, I'm joined by a truly inspirational guest who describes himself as a dreamer, schemer, lover, father, and adrenaline junkie. No, I'm not the guest. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Freddie Bennett.
Hello, everybody. It is a pleasure and an honor to be here talking to so many of you and obviously to speak to the legend that is Rory as well.
Thank you, dude. So if the name doesn't ring a bell, then I guess for everyone listening, do you remember the guy in the fisherman's costume? Wasn't it a fisherman's costume? It was, wasn't it?
Yep, it was. Bright yellow fisherman's costume. That's right.
That's awesome. We're going to get into a bit more detail about that. But just before we do dive into all that stuff, why don't you give me a bit of insight into a bit of history from your perspective and running up to your relationship with alcohol and why you signed up to One Year No Beer?
Sure, absolutely. So I worked out at an early age that I was very good at drinking. I was the stereotypical teenager. I've got fond memories of getting drunk for the first time when I was 15 years old, and my baggy white jeans got covered in mud because I was probably drinking in the local park or something. And then as a teenager and going into university, my drinking was probably stereotypical, let's say, for someone growing up in the late 90s. I would drink heavily at the weekends. I would party hard. I would start to pride myself on being the first person in a bar, the last person to leave, the person that would never turn down a shot. And then I started to almost wear it as a badge of honor and become this person who had created a whole persona around being a heavy drinker. And I quite liked it. It gave me popularity. It gave me a bit of an adrenaline buzz, to be honest, when you walk into a bar and everybody cheers and shouts your name and puts some disgusting purple drink in your hand and expects you to drink it. I carried on in my 20s. I left university. I started working as a rock and roll management consultant in the City of London. I was thinking, Rory, I probably would have been drinking in very similar bars, if not the same bar that that yourself and Andy were probably in back in the day.
Yep.
And I became in that sort of quite high pressure drinking situation where I would drink if I had a good day, I'd drink if I had a bad day, I would drink to celebrate, I'd drink to commiserate. I would then start to get into a pattern of drinking on a Tuesday night and a Thursday night. And I'd always have these phrases like, Thursdays are the new Fridays, which meant I could go out and get absolutely hammered on a Thursday night. And then before you know it, Wednesdays would be the new Thursdays and Tuesdays would be the new Wednesdays. But I would still be there feeling proud of myself because I would say Monday night, that's an alcohol-free night. And I'd wear that like a badge of honor. And my relationship with alcohol, I think, was actually quite reversed. So I drank a bit as a teenager, say when you're, 15, 16, 17. But I was a well-behaved teenager. I wasn't one of these kids that goes off the rails and totally loses themselves in alcohol and drugs. I was very well-behaved. I always did my homework. I did well at school because I worked my ass off, not because I was particularly clever, and I was very conscientious. But what I didn't realize at the time was a lot of alcohol was surrounding me in my household. So my parents were both heavy drinkers. My mum used alcohol as a support for her mental health. My dad would just plow through wine and cigarettes like there was some kind of Brexit shortage about to happen. he would happily get through, you know, 3 bottles of red wine and 40 cigarettes a night, and he wore that like a badge of honor as well. So it's fair to say I came from a drinking family. And then at university, I was a typical university student that would get drunk 2 or 3 times a week. But then it starts to go in reverse, because almost when I left university and I went to my late 20s and into my 30s, rather than settling down and focusing on my career and thinking I had some fun when I was younger and now let's settle down a bit, I turned it up a notch. I turned that dial up to 11. I would still be going out drinking. And then without even noticing, the scale starts to tip when you have all these good times and great laughs with your friends and great experiences and funny stories, but they started to be slowly outweighed by the anxiety, by the depression, the crippling hangover. The hilarious stories started to turn to looks of concern and people saying, "Are you okay? You've been hitting a bit hard recently." And you know, that's when the stories start to come up of for example, getting so drunk I didn't remember getting back to my hotel room and pretty much missed a flight home to the airport whilst on a works trip. And that would be bad enough.
We've all done that.
Yep. I was in a country where alcohol was currently illegal.
Right.
Which was a Middle Eastern country that I won't name, but I'm not sure if I'm allowed back there. I'm sure I am, but
this podcast goes viral.
It was things like being away on a works conference. Everyone has a good night in the bar until 2 a.m, and I then locked myself out of my hotel room, which would have been great, except I was naked at the same time. So you clearly have some issues there if you happen to bump into your boss in the corridor. And
visiting another room, is that why you were?
I wasn't actually. I was very good. I'm sure it was one of those things where you think it's a toilet door and you think, oh, hang on, I'm looking at a pot.
I'm now peeing in a pot plant.
And then having to run down to reception with that pot plant covering my modesty. And it started to get to the stage where these stories are hilarious when you tell them the next day, but then you start to get the creeping thought inside your brain that maybe this isn't okay. And then you start to think, I haven't got a drinks problem, obviously, because I'm not waking up and drinking.
The funny thing is that maybe it's not okay is met in society with, oh, don't be ridiculous. We've all done that.
Exactly.
So you're like, oh, well, maybe I'll just carry on then. Maybe I'll just do it again. And then a few people, depending on what social circle you're in. So if you're in London, if you're in the city environment, they'll be like, ah, yeah, great story, hilarious. We've all got them, you know, little notch or whatever it is.
Yeah.
But then maybe some family or maybe some closer people or not in that environment are saying, hang on a minute, that's not normal.
Yeah, absolutely. And it was certainly getting like that. And I started to get this feeling, and it was around the end of the last few months of 2018. And, you know, all these embarrassing stroke worrying stories were stacking up, you know, things like blacking out and going missing during my 30th birthday, which you say, well, that's fine. It's your 30th birthday. You're allowed to have a good time. It's like, yeah, but I don't remember 6 hours of that night. And I still couldn't honestly tell you if I was safe or where I was or anything else. And these slight stories were starting to stack up, and I was struggling with my career for a number of reasons. A key factor as well saying was that my heavy drinking father taught me that life is short and that life is precious. And that is a lesson that I will always cherish. Unfortunately, he had to teach me that lesson by dying very suddenly.
Oh my God.
And that was, in fact, it was 3 years this Sunday that
he
died.
I'm sorry.
So that was a very typical day at work. I was sat there in an office in Manchester with a hangover, moaning at a spreadsheet, sat in my office saying, this computer's not working. Surely my day can't get any worse. My life is an absolute disaster. And then the phone rang. To cut a long story short, I had to jump into a car and drive 300 miles down to Bath, where he lived. Nothing on me, still wearing my suit, carrying my work bag. Got to hospital, and then a couple of hours later, I watched him die. So I had that day where you're having a normal lunchtime, and then by 8 o'clock that evening, I've watched my father die. And he didn't die exactly from alcohol poisoning, but it certainly didn't do him any good, and it was messy up his insides, and he sort of died very suddenly and very quickly. And in the same vein, he woke up and had breakfast that morning, and he didn't know that he was going to die that day. And the Hollywood version of the story would be that I said, right, I'm going to turn my life around. I've seen the damage that alcohol can do. This is the wake-up call that I've needed. But that's the Hollywood version. The Freddie version is that I turned the notch up even harder. And I use this excuse of, you only live once, life is short, have no regrets. But I used it to try and destroy myself in terms of even heavier drinking.
I just want to say that that is not the Freddie version. No, you are amongst the majority. That is the majority is... Mm-hmm. That we find these critical moments and then deal with it by compounding them and self-destruct and everything else like that. It's almost the way we're taught to, I guess. Parents taught us to do it, society taught us to do it, push it down, etc. So
exactly.
But you turned it up to now we're at notch 15, are we?
Yeah, I think we've probably broken the scale now, and it was again, and maybe podcast listeners will relate to this. It still wasn't the losing my home, losing everything on a park bench kind of situation, but it was still things that people listening may recognize. It was the whole, I'm going out for two drinks tonight and I've told my wife I'll be home by 10 o'clock, but then actually you're falling through the door at 6 in the morning. It was the whole rushing to get the kids to bed and being short and impatient and being... frankly, a crappy father, because I knew once they were in bed, I could sit there opening a bottle of wine and happily get through that bottle of wine. It was the going for a social night out with friends and it being a nice meal and a couple of drinks, but you're sneaking a couple of extra drinks in the kitchen whilst everyone else is in the lounge. It was those small drip nuggets of self-destruction, really. Like I say, it wasn't falling off a big cliff. It was just doing these things where you know in your heart of hearts, this isn't cool. This isn't how I'm going to be the best version of me. But you can't help doing it because you like the buzz. It makes you feel better. It feels a little bit naughty. And you get into that vicious cycle where you feel a bit bad about it, but you know what's going to make you feel better and cure that anxiety. And that will be a cheeky drink.
Yeah.
And as I say, and stop me if I'm going on for too long, by the way, I'm on a roll now.
It's great. Everyone would much rather hear from you than me, so don't worry.
Well, I don't know about that, but I'll keep on going on. And so it was interesting, around the end of 2018, I started to get a feeling. I say, I had this whole new aspect on life that my dad had given me, or his death had given me, that I didn't want my life to be a waste. I wanted to inspire people. I wanted to be the best version of myself. I said, I wasn't doing great at home. I wasn't doing great at work. You just know when you're not in the zone and when your life isn't going in the right direction. And I was there. And I've always had this goal that I knew that if I could stop drinking for a year, I could become unstoppable. I could do things I'd only imagined and dreamt of. I knew I could be the absolute best version of myself. And I wouldn't have to spend lots of money. I wouldn't have to go on any long trips. All I had to do was give up alcohol for a long period of time. And I knew deep down that it would absolutely revolutionize my life. But yet still, I didn't do it. I got through Christmas because you have to drink at Christmas because everyone drinks at Christmas. And then you get to
That's
New
the purpose
Year.
Of it, right?
Yep, exactly. And you get to New Year and you think, right, dry January, but New Year's Day blues. So I'm going to have a drink on New Year's Day. And all those losers are having no drinks in January. Everyone knows that that's bad for you. And you know, when your mates call up all these absolute rubbish stats about how dry January does you more damage than not, you know, moderating and everything like that. And so I still told myself this story, and I was still telling myself this story that I was going to get everything that I dreamed of, and I could still drink most days of the week and maybe get absolutely obliterated once a month or so. And it sounds a bit of a cliche, but then one morning on the 8th of March this year, I woke up on a work day on a Friday with a killer hangover, about 2 hours sleep in me. And I literally woke up and I said, I've had enough of this. I'm sick and tired of being sick and tired. And I've got a phrase that I use a lot at the moment, and that is, to get the things you've always wanted, you have to do the things you've never done before.
Amen.
And that's what I go for. And I said, I'm so determined in my life not to be one of those people that says, oh, I wish I'd done that, but I didn't have the time, or I could have done that, or I should have done that. Because I know that my dad said that, and I know that he died with regret, and that's not a nice thought. And I'm so determined to make an impact with my life and impact other people and to help other people, that I know in order to do that, I have to step out of my comfort zone. And for me, alcohol's not just a crutch or a comfort blanket. It's this whole comfort zone that I've designed around myself. So I have to now show it the middle finger and say, if I want these things, if I want to be the business owner, the husband, the father, the world record holder, then I have to turn my back on this. And to be honest, once I made that decision, I wouldn't say it was easy, but I felt turbocharged. I felt bulletproof. I felt, even though some of the days of my 1 year no beer journey have been tough, I felt that I could manage it with the help of such an amazing community and yourself and Andy and Jen and everyone else.
Awesome. That is amazing. Thank you. Well done to you, because it's a phenomenal journey. So tell me a bit about what started to change for you when you made that commitment, and a bit about your journey.
So my journey was not an easy one. So I signed up to 1 year no beer, as I say, on Friday, I believe it was the 8th of March, or 9th of March. That evening, so I'd been on my 1 year no beer journey for about 8 hours. That evening, I was told to go to my son's, or I'd asked to go to my son's spring fair at school, help out like parents do. And a lady came up to me and said, oh, brilliant, Freddie, you're here. Would you mind manning the bar for a couple of hours? So wasn't even day one. It was hour 8 of 1 year no beer. And I was there surrounded with alcohol. And the lady saying, oh, obviously, help yourself to a couple of beers as a thank you. And it was almost like 1 year no beer has been a number of crossroads. I knew I could take the easy option and the easy path and just say, you know, get the weekend out of the way, then I'll start on Monday. Or, you know, I'll have a couple and not tell anyone. I won't get drunk, I'll just have a couple of beers. And then I thought, or I could take the difficult path and say no to alcohol. And I knew if I could get through that evening, you know, a Friday night without alcohol was brilliant on its own. But turning down free alcohol, especially in a small school hall where there's 200 kids tearing around, I thought that'd be a brilliant start. And that's been one of my key learnings from 1 year no beer, really is, and I think some people struggle with this, there is never a perfect time. It's the way of saying, I had this as well. You always say, well, there's a big night out with my friends, or there's just a birthday, or there's just Christmas, or there's just Tuesday, or there's just something. People always make an excuse. I did it for so long. And another saying I have with these things is, say you're going on a journey, you're literally going on a journey and you're leaving your house. You never wait until every traffic light has turned green before you leave the house. Because if you waited for that, you would never leave and you'd never start your journey.
Totes.
So you have to say, I don't care that some of the lights are red. I don't care. There's never going to be a perfect time. Just decide to do it and just begin. And once you began, as I did, that then feels like such an achievement. And then you get proud of yourself and you do a day and then you do that first weekend.
Well, I think you couldn't have asked for a better experience, because the moment after commitment is one of your strongest moments. Okay? So the fact that you were presented with A, Friday, B, free alcohol behind the bar, right? I mean, we're stacking up the things here. Yeah. Like, I mean,
definitely.
Wow. So you've got the momentum of purchase that then builds almost instantly. You're so lucky that that happened then and didn't happen 5 days, 6 days, maybe even 7 days down the track. Maybe you had easy 3 or 4 days and you didn't actually have any win to get over. Because you are somebody who likes to crunch down your win. Like you go out there and you just go and get shit done. And I think that's driven by your experience by your dad and that, you know, very powerful the thing you said that he lay on his bed with regret. So you were like, I must. So you need these things. So that's why you were presented with that. And it gave you such a platform then to keep going and keep going.
Yeah.
And keep going. So you're, I, you know, you're absolutely spot on. There is no perfect timing. And as I always say to people, if you look ahead and you see an event and you think you can't do it, that's why you should do it.
Exactly. Yeah. And funny you should say that, because then I come into another part of my one year no beer journey in trying to live the life I want to live. And as I said earlier, I know I'm quite extreme in my views and the challenges I want to set myself. And quite frankly, I think of myself as an ordinary guy that's just decided to do some extraordinary things. And that's one of my new missions and goals in life, is to help other people do the same. And, you know, before 1 year no beer, I did things like I ran 250 miles through the Sahara Desert in a race called the Marathon de Sable, which is commonly known as the world's toughest ultra marathon. You know, I did the world's highest bungee jump. I cage dived with great white sharks. And so a bit like my drinking habits almost, I don't do things by halves. I do things to the extreme. And then with this new energy and confidence that 1 year no beer gave me, I thought, well, let's try and do what I love. I've talked about this life that I love doing. Let's actually make it happen. And that was only because, say, 1 year no beer had given me confidence. It had given me more time. It had given me a clearer head. I didn't have that alcohol-fueled anxiety that was whispering in my ear saying, you can't do this. Don't be stupid. Just sit back where life is comfortable and okay and have a beer. I had this turbocharge, and then it started to roll quite quickly. So I've done a few marathons before, but when I hit, it would have been when I hit 90 days on the day, I ran the Manchester Marathon and I knocked almost 40 minutes off my PB time.
Wow.
So yes, my PB before 1 year no beer was something like 3:48. Then after 1 year no beer, I was running a marathon in 3 hours, 19 minutes.
Wow.
And that was awesome. And then we had the marathon, and then I thought, well, I quite like this. And my children being kids weren't impressed by a marathon PB or by running through the Sahara Desert for a week. They said, well, Daddy, we'd like
gig.
To break. I know, exactly. Like, you can't please some people, can you? And they said, well, Daddy, we want you to break a world record. And I said, okay, fine. Because, you know, the kids got the Guinness Book of Records for Christmas. They like reading through it. And they said, well, why aren't you in here, Daddy? And because I'd had that alcohol-free confidence, I said, well, you know what, why not? And I looked for some suitable records, and I thought, I'll do something with running. I looked at, you know, you could be the fastest marathon dressed as a cheerleader or a postman or a cricketer or anything, or a pint glass, ironically. All those times are quite quick. I know. It should be the fastest record to run away from a pint glass. Now
being
exactly. Pint glass. Kicking it down the road saying, not today, pint glass.
And in that world record.
Yes. And to us, those records are too fast for me. They were sub 3 hours. But then I saw this one called the world's fastest fisherman, which was the fastest marathon ever dressed as a fisherman. And, you know, my kids being little boys, they love fishing and fish and everything. I live in Liverpool, which has got quite a fine maritime tradition. So I thought, yeah, I'll give this a crack. Wrote off the Guinness Book of Records. Hello, I'd like to break this, please. Didn't think anything more about it. And then they wrote back and said, yep, okay, you're on. And at the time, I was like, shit, I haven't even signed up for a marathon. I better sign up for one. And so I quickly signed up for the Liverpool Marathon in May, and I read the instructions, and they said, you know, got to wear a waterproof hat, fine, waterproof jacket, waterproof trousers, you know, a bit hot, but okay, I'll do that. Carry a 3 kilo fishing box. And I was like, well, that's tough, but okay, I'll take that on the team, you know, take it on the chin. And they said, and you have to wear welly boots. And that was the thing that I hadn't encountered. So I always thought, you know, dress as a fisherman, wear some trainers, that's fine. But you had to wear proper rubber welly boots. Couldn't fit your trainers inside them. Couldn't cut, I believe I tried everything. You can't cut out the soles of your shoes, can't wear something over the top and do some kind of little trick where to make it easy for yourself. Once again, I thought about taking the easy option, but what I realized was the most rewarding thing to do was having to suck it up and do not what was easy, but what was hard. Mm. And then a matter of weeks later, and this would have been in May, so probably about 110 days-ish into my alcohol-free journey, I found myself on the start line, the Liverpool Marathon, dressed as a fisherman in my welly boots, saying, right, here we go, with official world record attempt sign on my back. And to be honest, it was crazy. Within the first mile, I knew that I was in serious trouble. My feet were already killing me. When my family saw me at 10 miles in, most of my toenails had fallen off by then. And apparently my family said he's not going to make it. And then I had that horrible thing where I think for about 2.5 hours, I was pretty sure I was going to fail. And we talk about blips on the alcohol-free journey, and we talk about facing failure. But I almost think this is almost worse, because if you have a blip, you can say that, you know, you've worked out a way that didn't happen this time. And you're having to sort of tell people in the group, especially, that you didn't do things quite well. And I was thinking on a similar route, and I was having to still run this bloody marathon with my toenails rattling around my welly boot, thinking I failed, and how am I going to explain to people that I failed? How am I going to go into the group, into the 1 year no beer community, after making all this big, look at me, I'm going to break a world record? And to be honest, I was probably being a bit arrogant about it, and I was being a bit blasé about it. And then to turn around and say, you know what, guys, I've messed up here, I've failed. I couldn't believe it. But still, for some reason, even though failure was such a real prospect, I thought I could either quit and just sit down and say, this journey is worthless, I've failed. Or I could still say, yep, I might fail this time, but I'm going to carry on. And you're going to get another one of my phrases here now. Clearly got a book of them. And they said, you know, if you've got your car and you get a puncture in a car tire, what do you do? Do you slash the other three tires just to really wreck your whole car? Or do you focus on what's gone wrong and make sure you fix it? And that's what I did. I just focused on putting one foot in front of the other. And I think I had about 3 miles to go when I thought I might do this. And I thought, I'm either going to just fail it by literally a minute or so, or I'm going to do it. And then I just had to, no matter how many people laughed at me on that race, and I thought I'd get lots of support, and a lot of people just shouted at me, you're a bloody idiot and you're stupid, especially because by then I was, you know, I could hardly walk. I was pretty much crying. By this stage, the blood was sloshing around my welly boots. And I know it sounds, you know, great at the time, but you've got people telling you, because you're doing something different and you're standing out from the crowd. And by doing so, I was literally saying, look at me, I'm here as a bright yellow fisherman, causing myself lots of pain. And people are saying, you're going to fail. You're not going to do this. You're stupid for even trying. Why don't you just give up? But then to still keep on going through something that's so painful, then to cross the finish line was an amazing experience. And to break that world record by, wow, it turned out I broke it by, I think, about 6 minutes.
Wow.
And then to have the man on the microphone say, you're a Guinness World Record holder, and to see my kids there, they ran the last, you know, 20 meters with me.
Oh.
And then, yeah, it was unbelievable. But I couldn't have done that. I couldn't be a world record breaker if I hadn't had the confidence the 1 year no beer gave me. And as I said earlier, I I don't think I'm anything special. I'm not a runner. I'm not an athlete. At school, I was the overweight kid who was asthmatic and the slowest kid in his class. At university, I was the heavy drinker. At work, I was the heavy, heavy drinker. I am not that guy that you see in the office who is always running half marathons every morning and eating clean and never drinking. I was the party boy that was doing so many things I shouldn't, that was destroying my life in so many ways. But just because I decided that I didn't want to tolerate that version of myself anymore, I didn't want to tell myself that story. I wanted to tell myself a different story and start to live the dream that I imagined. And because of 1 year no beer, I was able to do that.
That's amazing, mate. Really amazing. Thank you. I mean, what an amazing story. And I think a lot of people resonate that. I mean, I certainly was reflecting back on a whole bunch of my life, but also the guys I work with and, you know, and that party boy lifestyle that is synonymous with our jobs and so many of them, and hoping they make the same realization someday. But yeah, so you tell me about some of the benefits and to going alcohol-free, because we haven't really dug into that. What changed for you? What changed in your life? What changed in your health?
Sure. So in terms of my life, the clarity and the positivity is one of the key benefits. One thing I don't talk about too much is that I struggled with mental health issues in the past. I was certainly at a stage in my life. I had the Samaritans, the UK suicide helpline. I had them on speed dial. I went through counselling. I went through cognitive behavioural therapy. I was spending a lot of time with my GP trying to get over this anxiety and depression. Because of going alcohol free, my head is in the best place it's been for years. The anxiety isn't out the window. I'm not bouncing off the walls like some toddler that's had too much fizzy drinks and, being one of these really happy clappy people saying life is amazing. But it's more of a quieter inner strength that says anything that comes my way, I can deal with it. I'm so much more calmer with my kids. I'm a better father. I used to fly off the handle when something went wrong at home. And that was because really I wasn't angry at the children or angry at the washing machine that had broken. I was angry at myself because firstly, I didn't know how I could cope with it. And secondly, I knew that this thing would maybe distract me from being able to drink that day. So say my mental health, my positivity, my inner strength has got so much better. My time has got so much better spent. I'm busier than I ever was and I feel calmer than I've ever been. So, since going alcohol-free, I've broken the world record. I've run the marathon. I've done an Ironman despite never having done a triathlon before. I've launched a new business. I am writing a book that I haven't even talked about to you guys in the group yet. People have said you should write a book. So I sat down. I'm now 12,000 words into that book.
Wow.
I journal every day. I meditate. I'm like I've gone to the Great Life Superstore and done like a supermarket sweep and just stole everything off the shelf. And it is just that time. And you know what? I'm clearly someone with an addictive personality that likes adrenaline rushes.
Yeah.
But I'm almost getting addictive to being so productive. And now and we talk about our whys a lot in 1 year no beer. And now I've always had things like kids, obviously want to be a great dad for them, want to have a better life. But I've had so much more time and energy to do all these things. Now it's like, I don't want to drink. And even if I did want to drink, I know I couldn't do it because I don't want to waste a day being hungover. And that's half of the story. It's not just the mental health damage it does or the time that's wasted. It's about just being able to get so much shit done. And I'm finally starting to see where I want to be. And I know that you look at any successful person in life or anyone that you look up to, it could be an athlete, a business person, even just someone that you know in your friends and family. I guarantee that they are either alcohol free or a very, low alcohol in what they do and are clearly better than a lot of us are controlling their alcohol intake. Anyone, depending, no matter what your definition of success, anyone that you deem to be successful, I guarantee they're not out getting trashed three nights a week, and they're not spending days in bed hungover, or they're not putting their kids in front of a film like I did so I could just sleep off on the sofa. They're focused and committed in their life. And you know, I believe that we're all superheroes. I believe that we are all unstoppable, incredible people. But it's a phrase I use in the group quite a lot. I believe that we are all stars in our own superhero movie, especially in the One Year No Beer community. And you would never go and see a Marvel superhero movie where you sit down, the superhero turns up, he's perfect, or he or she spends 2 hours having a really easy time, everything goes their way, they beat the baddie, the end. None of us would pay to watch that movie because it's so dull and it's so uninspiring. For superheroes to be super, they have to go through hard times. They have to fall. They have to get knocked down a few times. But we know by the end of the movie, they will rise up and they will defeat their enemy and they will rise up against the odds and they will be victorious. And that's what I believe we can all be. And we're supposed to go through tough times, I believe. And I know I've been through so many, but it's how we overcome it and how we bounce back that really makes a difference. And that's one of the key benefits from One Year No Beer, that I feel no matter what life throws at me now, I won't find it easy, but I know that I can cope with it and I know I can still emerge victorious, and it won't be easy and it won't be fun, but I'm going to have the inner strength to do it and go on and make my dreams come true and conquer the next list of challenges that I've got lined up.
Which sounds like, it sounds like quite a list. And, you know, just, it's really inspirational, you know, your journey and the way you've shared it with the community, and the community absolutely love it. I mean, your posts are always incredibly engaged and very funny. And I don't know what filter you use, but you always manage to make yourself look like you've got 14 abs. There was no envy there at all. None. No envy.
Wow, Rory, I'm the envious of you. You've got a great body under that t-shirt. I know it.
Under that extra kilo of fat. No, anyway, 2-4 kilos. Sidestep slightly. There's something. Tell me about Steve.
You know, I grew up as an only child. I was born in 1982. So, what a decade to be born in. My dad was, as I say, a creative genius. He was very into computers. He was probably into computers and computer programming even more than he was into alcohol. He loved technology. He loved inventing things. He was that stereotypical guy who had great ideas and could create brilliant things, but had zero business sense. And then my dad started working with a guy called Steve. Steve lived in America. And one day, basically, my dad came in and he said, right, I'm going to start working with Steve. Pack your bags, everybody. We're going to move to America. So being a 6-year-old, it would have been in 1988. I packed up my shell suit and my Sony Walkman, and we flew over and we lived in America for 2 years. And things worked out pretty well with my dad and Steve. They invented some quite cool things. It was basically, my dad's claim to fame was he invented a way to record sound on computers. Wow. And now that's something obviously we take for granted, but he invented a piece of software that would record what you're saying and play it back to you, which in 1988 was a pretty big deal. But things went a bit sour between Steve and my dad. My parents were argued quite a lot. My mum didn't want to go to America. She was lonely. They were both drinking too much. And Steve and my dad fell out. Now it turns out that Steve's last name was Jobs. As in Steve Jobs, as in the founder of Apple. So needless to say, things worked out a lot better for Steve Jobs financially than it did for my dad. Wow. Because we flew back home to England very quickly. I thought we were coming back for a summer holiday. And only when we got home did my dad say, oh, by the way, you're never going to go to your school again, never see your friends again. That life that you built for yourself as an 8-year-old child, you've just left that, and you never had a chance to say goodbye. But so that was tough to take. But my dad's claim to fame was he um he was Steve Jobs' business partner for a while, until he pissed him off and got fired, basically. Wow. But who would have known? So yeah, Steve Jobs grew up in those, lived in those mansions in California. Growing up, my parents hid behind the sofa and made me answer the door to the debt collectors because they know that the bailiffs can't enter a house if a child answered the door. So slightly different lives, but there you go. And you know what? I wouldn't change it for the world. And again, we could tell ourselves a story and we could tell ourselves so many things about why we drink, about my childhood was rubbish, my parents argued. Someone was abusive to me. Someone, took me away from my friends. Someone broke my heart. I had all those things and I used it as a story to tell myself for so long. And I would give myself a hard time and then I'd drink to feel better. Then I'd feel bad for drinking. So I'd drink some more. And then as our great man, Tony Robbins says, change your story, change your life. And that's what I tried to do. And you know what? I love the fact that so much shit happened to me as a child, as a teenager, and even in my 30s, because now I feel like it's made me bulletproof. Only thanks to 1 year no beer and being alcohol free, I feel I finally got the power to take whatever is ahead of me. And now I not only want to do that for myself, but I want to help as many people as I can to do the things they thought they couldn't do, to take themselves out of their comfort zone and to do the things they once thought impossible.
Amazing. Really amazing. You're an amazing human. And I'm excited to see what more comes from you going forward. Exactly as you said, the book, we'll be finding out about that soon. And we'll definitely be hearing more from you in 1 year no beer anyway. Before we finish up, what are your top tips for people being alcohol free?
So my top tips are, number one, never a perfect time to start, so just do it. As I said earlier, we just have to decide, just wake up one day and say, this is how it's going to be, this is what I have to do, and just decide to do it. Tip two would be, think about your whys. And I know that's a cliche, but there's something more to it, because it's not about the goal. It's about the structure that you put behind it because of your whys. So everyone goes into 1 year no beer saying, I want to change my relationship with alcohol. Some people succeed. Some people take a lot longer to succeed. And why is that? And I believe the people to succeed have not a stronger why, but they almost put a greater structure around themselves. And I suppose a non-technical way is you can't do it half-assed. If you're going to do it, then think about your alcohol-free drinks. Think about maybe not hanging around certain people if you know they're going to be pouring shots down your throat. Having all that structure around it, just sitting on the sofa and saying, I've paid my money, I'd like to give up alcohol now, please, isn't going to be enough. It is a difficult journey sometimes, but if you're prepared to go on that journey, the rewards are unbelievable.
Yeah.
Tip three is a tactical one. Alcohol-free beers. I'm 6 months in, actually. Tomorrow is my 6-month anniversary.
Hey!
I've got the post ready to go. I still drink alcohol-free beers like there's no tomorrow, because I know Friday night at home I'm going to want a beer. Saturday night at home when I'm cooking, I'm going to want a beer. Sunday night, I don't drink them every day, but especially over the weekend, you know what, if I knock back 6 or 7 Heineken Zeros, that's great. I'm happy with that. I'd rather do it that than 7 or 8 Heineken 5s. Then the final point is, this may not apply to everyone, but it's set yourself a challenge to do something different. And like I said, I know what I do is very extreme, and quite frankly, people would be stupid to do what I do, because I know I am. But it's set yourself a goal, whether it is, it's running a Spartan race, for example, or it is doing a park run. It doesn't have to be exercise focused. It could be to get into yoga once a week. You know, I had something like, if I got to 90 days, I was going to say, I'm going to buy myself a new iPad. It doesn't have to be necessarily run a marathon, but you have to have something to reward yourself. And also I think in life, there's so little validation these days in a world when everyone is screaming out for validation for no reason, when people really bloody earn it, like by doing through 1 year no beer. Our group is amazing. Our group is one of the most wonderful things I've ever encountered. But the outside world may not turn around and throw you a party and go, yay, maracas, 90 days. Everyone else in the world is like, well, I've got shit to do. I've got the kids to pick up. Oh, yeah, well done. You haven't had a drink for a while. Life goes along around you. So set yourself a challenge and give yourself a reward for doing it.
Brilliant.
And even if, I mean, look at our legendary Sharon when she got to 365.
Yeah.
Her reward was on her own, and she thought about it and she planned it and she took herself away for an amazing retreat. And sometimes you have to do something just for you, and it feels a bit selfish in this day and age, but just putting yourself first and thinking, I am going to go to that health spa. I am going to get that massage. I am going to buy that iPad. Yeah, I should probably buy things like, you know, mortgage payment or shopping. You know, it's about... Sometimes you have to put yourself first, and alcohol sometimes makes us so selfish, but this is being selfish in a different way. It's rewarding yourself for doing something amazing and going on such an unbelievable journey.
Yeah.
And if people go on that journey and they embrace it, then the rewards really are limitless.
Absolutely. Amazing. Great tips. Freddie, thank you so much for being a part of One Year No Beer. Thank you for everything you're doing for the community and the group.
Well done
on your journey. You're just such an inspiration. And thanks for coming on the podcast.
Thank you. A pleasure. And I look forward to meeting everyone in person very soon.
Absolutely.
Thanks for listening to the 1 Year No Beer podcast. For a full list of episodes and to join in the challenge yourself, head on over to oneyearnobeer.com.